Well, now a first-hand account of a nation where we have more than 600 troops, that's captivated us for many years, that's full of real life and death dramas, not just financial meltdowns, and where politics creates disproportionately big characters, if you think about it, given the size of the country, one of whom we'll meet now. And in a way, he's unusual because he's an opposition member of Parliament, and we don't meet many East Timorese opposition representatives here in Australia. Dr. Mari Alkatiri comes with quite a CV in tow. Throughout the Indonesian occupation of Timor, he became a refugee in Mozambique, and he eventually returned in 1999 at the head of the Fretilin Group to emerge as the independent country's first prime minister under President Xanana Gusmão. Now, that alliance shattered during the tense showdown 2 years ago, during which Xanana virtually put his reputation on the line and said he wouldn't continue to serve with Dr. Alkatiri, and Alkatiri yielded, though he's remained Secretary General of Fretilin. That's just a potted history of this very active man who's still very concerned about fragility inside his nation, but who's arrived in Australia on a bold new strategic mission, which he'll put to Kevin Rudd on Tuesday in Canberra. So let's hear him outline his case. Welcome, Dr. Alkatiri, to Saturday Extra.
Good morning.
I wonder, the idea that Timor-Leste could use its strategic position on the cusp of both Asia and the Pacific as a bridge between the two nations. Is this a new direction that you're trying to carve out, just you and Fretilin, or is there a consensus about this in your country?
I think that we still need a brainstorming on these ideas, because there's no doubt that Timor-Leste has geopolitically a very strategic position. And the country has some potentials too, oil and gas, and we still need it now is to build up human capacity. Mm. And then it's the most important. The priority is how to build human capacity, human capital.
And how would this work? I mean, how would this bridge be developed?
As you know, we are in between two giants, Australia and Indonesia. And when you are in between two giants, you have to have a clear policy of not being part of one or of another, but being actively bringing both together. This is one thing. Secondly, Indonesia is a very big country with still a lot of problem of development in the eastern part of Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And Timor-Leste can really be the poles for the development of the region, of the sub-regions, being a small country but with a lot of attention, international community attention to it. I think we still can attract investors, not only for Timor-Leste, but for the region, for the sub-regions, eastern part of Indonesia, Timor-Leste, even the northern part of Australia, and being a triangle of that region that can really start as a base for cooperation with Southeast Asia and Pacific.
Now, in a way, you haven't been, I'd suggest to you, in Australia, the image isn't of you as trying to foster this sort of thing. That wasn't what you were really known for. Are you changing, or are you trying to reposition yourself?
No. I was painted in such a way to damage my image by a lot of people for the simple reason that I had to govern the country after 24 years of illegal occupation. And I had to build a state, an independent state, to build an independent nation. It is not easy to do it. How to get a small country between two giants to be a sovereign and independent? And then, really, some people here in Australia didn't like me.
I remember you said that very loudly.
And even in Indonesia, other people in Indonesia, they don't like me because I was really struggling hard to get Timor-Leste to be really an independent country. Not against Indonesia, not against Australia, but being an independent country, and to get back what I really at time and still think that what are our right to benefit from the resources in the Timor Sea.
So you'll be meeting our Prime Minister next week. How will you be expressing what you'd like to see happen?
I was the leader of the whole negotiation on Timor Sea, including Sunrise.
The original one.
Yeah, the original one. Now I do believe that there's no negotiation now happening. There's some statement from the current government of Timor-Leste that sometimes I don't agree with their kind of statements. Mm. I think that we are now in the stage of technical negotiation and not political.
But this is now about where the LNG plant might be and the nature of the pipeline.
The nature of the negotiation is very different. It's very technical. And it's better not to politicize too much this stage of negotiation.
So actually, you're leaving that. You don't wish to buy into that at all.
No. I'm still interested in to be involved in this.
Because I got the impression that you actually would like a seat at the table.
I think that the for Timor-Leste, the oil and gas issue is a national issue. Mm. You can't really let this issue to others because this is yours, also yours. And being now in the de facto opposition, I think that I still have some expertise in this area.
It's interesting, really, because sometimes when I read the material about you, it's almost like you'd ideally like a government of national unity. It's part of you would, in that you feel that there needs to be some new breakthroughs in your country, but also that you do want power in your own hands as well. I mean, so I just wonder how you're sensing the best form of development for your country.
Immediately after the 2007 elections, we won the election with a simple majority, and we made clearly a proposal for all-inclusive or a grand inclusive government. Mm. We just came out from a crisis. The crisis that was a result of lack of inclusion, social inclusion within the government.
Well, I wonder.
This was a little lesson that we have learned from the crisis.
See, one of the other very interesting things at the time with you, I remember, when you were in charge as Prime Minister, was that you were very concerned about debt. Ironically, given that debt is in such the news these days, you were criticised for being too careful with the country's money, that you actually hadn't opened the purse strings enough and spent enough, and that the place was crying out for development, and you were, you know, very careful about the way in which any petroleum funds or the nation's coffers were used. Now, and just recently, I understand, the petroleum fund has been delved into to actually release some money for the subsidies of rice and fuel prices. How do you see the best expenditure of money?
I still keep my position. I never said that the oil revenues should never be used for the budget. The law is clear. Of course, you have to use the oil revenues to invest in the country, to develop the country, particularly in education, health, infrastructures. But being aware that the oil money is not really the money for these generations. It's money for all generations of Timorese people. This is the point. And this is the difference between my government and the current government.
So do you basically believe the current government is on the right track in terms of releasing money for expenditure on education, electricity, roads? Are they on the right track or are they on the wrong track?
The only thing that they are doing their expenditure in such a way that they are really throwing money for nothing. You need to have a clear program and a clear project and transparency in the procedures to use the money. There's no transparency at all. This is the problem.
Now, Fretilin wants to conduct what it's calling a peace march, which has been the subject of a considerable controversy of late, with the Prime Minister, Shanana Gushmao, saying very bluntly that he'd arrest people if they actually did come out and march in this sort of mass march, accusing Fretilin of stoking fires that should be left unstoked, that there's real risks to stability in the country. Are you going to have your peace march?
Surely. The peace march was a decision made 1 year ago. No one really reacted against the peace march a year ago. And suddenly now this government, because fails in dealing with a very important issue, they have failed. They have failed to deal with the restructuring of the police. They failed to deal with the army. Mm. They failed to deal with the IDPs. And then they are trying to blame others for their failure.
I take your point, but your country is extraordinary at the moment. It's still recovering from a lot of trauma. We had the failed assassination attempts earlier this year. Is this the time to be conducting mass...
I said that we decided it 1 year ago. Mm. It means that we have been really considering the right time to do it. We didn't really even decide on the right time to do it. But why the government is reacting if there is no really date for this march?
Oh, you haven't actually got a date?
No, nothing. This is our way of really directing the people's attention to other problems, because they've been criticized because of their corruption, bad administration, and so on. And now they are trying to really to direct the attention of the people to a different problem.
There is an anonymous pamphlet, as you know, circulating in Dili, threatening the whole democracy in violence if the new police commander from the east takes up the job as the head of police. And it's sort of this wretched east-west tension seem to have arisen again. And you yourself say the place is fragile. What do you personally take on as your responsibility to commit to peacemaking in your country?
The east-west problems is a problem created by Shanana himself in 2006. He should be blamed for this issue. Because he was the one that, as a head of state, made a speech to the nations and tried to divide the army into east and west. He did it publicly. He should be blamed for this. For us, Fretilin is a national movement. It's a national party.
Incidentally, was that not true, or was it just that he shouldn't have brought it out into public light?
I think that as a head of state, he should be much more responsible and trying to resolve the problems within the institution instead of bringing it to the public life.
What do you think is the greatest contribution to getting over the terrible divisions in your country? I think it gradually has dawned on Australians how divided Timor is.
We made already some proposals, clear proposals, to the Secretary General of the United Nations last December last year. A proposal of the creation of mechanisms to include others in the decision-making process, particularly on the restructuring of police, army, security and defense, good governance, public administrations, and justice. It was taken by the president. He started all the consultation between us and the alliance in the government. And suddenly, 2/11 happened. The assassination of the president, and then gets really stuck up to now. We think that the situation is so sensitive that everybody has to be on board.
So, in other words, you're saying that really Timor isn't yet ready for democracy as we know it.
For sure.
Because the next elections are in 2012, aren't they?
We are simultaneously building the nation and building the state. And to build a nation, we need to unite the people.
Some would say, of course, that that's exactly what democracies do best, better than anything else.
After the state is built, yes, the nation is built and the state is built, you can really decentralize. Decentralization is not divisions.
Mm.
It's a very different concept.
It can be perilously close to it, though, can't it? It's a tricky
decentralization thing. Decentralization is a devolution of power to really part of the community that is part of the whole nation.
You realise that some people might say, there he goes again. He, in many ways, he is retaining a lot of his attitudes from the past, that he would fit into the category of someone who would say, honestly, look, I think that we do need a sort of enlightened authoritarian government at this stage.
This is Shanana, not me.
That's Shanana.
This is Shanana. Shanana would like to govern without opposition. I would like to see in Timor-Leste a government that can include others in the decision-making process.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed. It's been very nice to welcome you to Saturday Extra. Dr. Mari Alkatiri, and he will be meeting our Prime Minister on Tuesday. Well, now we're going to go to some of your letters. We've just got time before the news to go to a range of letters. Chris Rigdon wrote, I found Geraldine's interview with Professor Gundel on Glamour extremely interesting and thought-provoking. It's great to explore some of the origins of this and so develop understandings of a phenomenon that is at the core of the modern-day popular culture that so dominates our lives. And we got a couple of letters like that, so thank you very much. I must say I enjoyed it a lot too. Prue Acton, who sends us some wonderful letters, she wrote actually last week, In the USA, the combination of low interest rates and reduced financial regulations, but also reduced environmental regulations, flowed from panic responses to September the 11th, and it has led to economic meltdown. In fact, this was the second oil shock to hit Western markets after the first in the early 70s. Oil shot to stratospheric prices as Chinese and Indian economies rode the wave of consumerism, fueled by low interest and free credit, moving their manufacturing to high carbon industries and towards Western lifestyles. Rather than realise that this heralded the end of the Western petrochemical dependent technology and move on to a low carbon economy, we wasted years and money flooding our markets with cheap, high carbon products and fueling such growth in CO2 emissions in China that can only rival the worst excesses of England's manufacturing expansion 200 years ago. Now in 2008, we have a golden opportunity to put past surpluses to work and move to a low carbon economy, including available renewable energy technology. And I notice, of course, on the news that the energy price is tumbling such a lot. Mind you, not here in Australia. Now there is a question that I wonder why isn't taken up more by a range of people. That in fact, of course, the oil-producing countries are going to limit supply. And my question posed about how many consecutive days the stock market could fall has provoked a lot of response. This is just one. Alan McLean writes, "Dear Geraldine, I was interested in your question to the listeners about how often you can reduce a quantity by 5%, wondering which of three possibly correct answers you would give. If the reduction is 5% of the starting value, that's the value at a fixed date, then 20 reductions will get you down to zero. That would be linear decay. And in most economic and related matters, this is rarely used. If the reduction is 5% of the previous value of the series, then in theory it takes an infinite number of reductions to get to zero, as you quoted. In practice, of course, in a relatively short and definitely finite time, you get down to the value of a cent, or whatever the unit of a quantity is. So in practice, you cannot reduce a series infinitely often." Look, I'm not a mathematician. I was prompted to ask that question, and I will read the answers extremely carefully. We're going to be back after the news to talk about shifting politics in these turbulent times of ours. 8 o'clock.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.